We can test and see how that goes.
Yeah. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second NIST lecture of the year. Today, I'm very pleased to introduce to you Rolf Lindemann from Knock Knock Labs. He's going to give a talk to us on security aspects of smartphone authentication. Rolf was also here yesterday for the NBL workshop, and the presentation is going to have some of the same elements as yesterday, but I'm quite sure that the audience will provide new and different questions compared to yesterday. So on that, Rolf, I leave you the floor. Please.
Thank you, Niels. So good morning, everyone. So I'm with Knock Knock Labs, which is a Silicon Valley-based startup in the authentication space, and we are one of the founders of the FIDO Alliance. So we work in authentication, and let's start with authentication and some context on that. So the times have changed. Right now we live in this service-centric decade, which means we are using services over the internet on a daily basis, and we have to authenticate to each of the services now. And you could even think now, since we are moving to the more the Internet of Things landscape, we have to authenticate to devices as well. So authentication gains importance, which is reason enough to understand the security of authentication and whether this that they can sustain the use of authentication in the past. And as you see here, right, if you want to maneuver a car using our smartphone, we better have some kind of good authentication to that. Otherwise, other people could maneuver the car and maybe even over the internet. But putting that into context, so the identity and access management space is a large one, and authentication is a small fraction of that, right? It starts with physical to digital identity, right? How can I know your name, your passport, your national ID card, at least the binding to that thing. There's the user management, right? Provision new users, deprovision users, and so on. There's the authentication space, and we will talk about authentication today. There's a federation on top of that, right? How, when after I've authenticated to one entity, how could I federate that information over to a separate entity? For example, I booked a flight on Lufthansa DE. Now I want to rent a car, right? Should I authenticate again to the rental car provider, or is it good enough for the rental car provider to just understand I'm a known customer to Lufthansa, right? And federate over to that thing. And of course, there's single sign-on, right, to reduce the number of user interactions per day, which we have. But let's talk about authentication, which is mainly, let's say, still username password-based, even though there's a strong authentication, which typically means an OTP, a one-time passcode, which we receive from a hardware token or from a text message. But there's also the risk-based aspect of that. But start with security and look into the existing threats we have seen on the internet of that thing. There's a predominant attack vector here, which is essentially people can steal your password from the server, right? You think, no, this is secure, and that's the reason why we store the hashed password only, right? Only the hash value of the password on the server side. But even though, right, people have managed to compute with rainbow tables to try brute force all the passwords, or the, let's say, the most likely passwords, and then compare to the hash value, and after that they found, oh yes, that's your password. Maybe you reuse that password at a different site. Now I can log in. So that's one of the attack vectors. The other is phishing, right? For a user, it's almost impossible to understand whether a site is a legitimate site or an application is a legitimate application. It's, you are only seeing a screen, right? And everyone could create the same screen to you as a user. So phishing is still a large-scale attack, and there are a lot of cases in reality where users are phished for passwords. And the third attack vector is, it's more complicated at going after, let's say, the one-time passcode scheme, essentially providing some kind of man-in-the-middle attack, right? You modify the banking transaction on your PC, it's a managed browser or man-in-the-middle attack. When you send the transaction to the bank, then people receive a one-time passcode on their mobile phone or use an OTP generator for that, and the man-in-the-middle can intercept that as well, right? Send that to the man-in-the-middle server, and the man-in-the-middle server will then authorize the modified transaction to the bank, which is great, and now people can steal money. And that's not only an academic, let's say, exercise. This has been found in the real world, right? This is real attacks. And more, if you look into the breach landscape, there are two main things. One is, there is cost associated with data breach, so there is value there. And if you look into the latest Yahoo attacks and the price Verizon is obviously willing to pay before the attacks and now after the attacks, we can attribute a certain value to each breach record, right? It's 1.5 billion records which have been breached there. It's a price reduction of $350 million. So you can compute the price per record in the end, and which is an interesting situation, right? And now we have a price tag on that thing, and we know what security is worth, right? If you protect the asset better, you can increase the company value, which is quite significant. But the second thing is that all the large incidents we have seen, or most of them, right? Studies say it's 95% of those incidents, they are somehow related to weak authentication, which is another reason to think about authentication and how we can make authentication stronger and more convenient for users. Okay, let's look into authentication and how it works. So there's some fundamentals to understand. We have servers which are typically far away, for example, in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, I don't know, in New York. Far away, then I'm here, I want to authenticate to that thing. And since human beings are not born with Wi-Fi interfaces in their heads, there's no direct way for me to authenticate remotely. Right? I need some kind of local device which I can interact with and do at least enter a password into or swipe my finger to, right? To do some kind of local interaction to a device in order to log into a remote server. And let's understand what that device provides as a front-end signal. And typically, yes, there's some risk engine in the back-end which takes all the information the risk engine can get, like round-trip times and so on, and calculate a risk score on that. And based on that risk score, which is a combination of the front-end signal and all the other signals it can collect, it makes a decision whether I finally can log in or perform the transaction or not. So since that device seems to be relevant, right, it needs two interfaces, one to the server, another to the user, let's give it a name, let's call it Authenticator. So from here on, I will just call it Authenticator in my presentation. And you see that that's the same terminology we use in the FIDO lines, for example, for that simple piece. And understand what that Authenticator is doing, right? It verifies the user on one hand side, which is a local interaction. And the second thing, it runs an authentication protocol to the server in some way. So it's essentially splitting up the authentication in two different pieces. A local interaction and some remote interaction. And this remote thing can be standardized. And if you want to think about standardization, let's find good ways to do the standardization. Let's use existing cryptographic protocols for that. And there's a challenge response protocol. There's asymmetric cryptography, which we certainly would prefer, because if someone steals or, let's say, manages to steal material from the server, we don't want this someone, this attacker, to steal private key material, right? We only want to store public keys on the server. So let's store public keys on the server, store a private key in the authenticator itself, and run some challenge response protocol, which means server sends me a random number, I assign the random number plus some other information and send that back, right? So that's kind of standardized authentication protocol. And with that approach, we gain some scalability, right? So the scalability means that the modality is not relevant for the server, right? So we can change modality from, for example, PIN entry to a finger swipe or to an iris recognition without having the need to change the server, which is really interesting because in a data center, like of the big internet players, you don't want to have servers for each country's authentication system or each modality. And whenever a new modality gets invented, you don't want to add yet another server supporting that new modality, right? You want to reduce the complexity on the server side, run a single, support a single standardized authentication protocol, but have the flexibility on the front-end side to support the modalities. And the second dimension of scalability is actually the way you implement the authenticator, right? There are different ways, different security mechanisms you could leverage, like the secure elements, USB tokens, TPMs, trusted execution environments, to make the authentication or the authenticator more secure. And if you really look into that, you understand that for the convenience, it's the modality and the implementation choices and the protocol choices are relevant for or dominating the security of the overall thing. So, but with this kind of scalability, with this flexibility, there's another question to be answered, right? So the implementation choice of the authenticator and the supported modality might determine the overall security, so the risk level of that authentication. So in the end, even though the server does not need to technically support each modality, the server might want to know what modality is being used just to understand how strong that authentication is in reality, whether the user had just to touch a single button or whether a fingerprint sensor was used, and whether the fault accept rate of the fingerprint sensor was in the 50% ballpark area, right, which is, let's say, almost nothing, or let's say 1 in 10,000, which state-of-the-art systems are today. So that's where attestation comes into play, where we want to cryptographically attest the model of the authenticator to the relying party. So some cryptographic proof. And the second thing, which is very important, since the user would have to give sensitive information to that authenticator, there's a question how the user could understand whether the authenticator is secure or not, right, from a privacy perspective. And you might remember there are these counterfeit products like the Rolex, right? How could the user determine whether this Rolex is the legitimate, the original one he might want to use, or a counterfeit product? And similar to the ATMs, right? How could I, as a normal user, understand whether there's a camera watching the PIN entry, the PIN pad of the ATM, or a card skimming attack to be mounted or being mounted at that ATM or not, right? It's very hard for me as a user, because I don't have a reference on that. It's the same for chips, right? SD cards, there are original ones, there are the counterfeit ones, in ICs, original ones, counterfeit ones. How could I detect that, right? Sometimes you see the counterfeit products are bad, right? I can even look at the printing on that device and make a decision based on that. But in reality, we have to do that decision internally from an electronics perspective, cryptographically secured, if the machine has to do the determination, or the user would have to look into some seals, the holograms attached to that. But it's very hard, right? For the user in the end, the only way to make sure it's a legitimate, it's a trusted authenticator is to say it's a user's authenticator, right? Not to say there is some authenticator somewhere and now you have to present your fingerprint or your iris even if you don't trust that device. No, say it's your authenticator, right? The users bring your own authenticator. In this case, the user can trust the authenticator and can come up with his own scheme how to select the authenticator, which authenticator to buy for a certain purpose. So the authenticator verifies the user on one hand. This is what you are or what you know. And the other thing is the authenticator needs to be present, right? There's still the key material inside the authenticator, so which is a second factor, which is kind of handy because now most authentication systems, from a regulatory perspective, are requiring a two-factor authentication. So we can combine these two factors in a single authenticator, and depending on how secure we implement the authenticator, it's really considered independent factors, right? If you look at the PSD2 regulation, the Payment Services Directive 2 in the European Union, and they say if it's, let's say, implemented in a, now they call it separated secure execution environment, right? In this case, it's considered two separate, two independent channels, two independent factors, and you can implement a single authenticator in a multipurpose device and use multi-factor factor authentication and that thing. Good thing to have, and we all already have those phones which are capable of that. Now let's look into the, let's say, the details of the security. What changes if you say it's the user's authenticator, right? Then obviously, right, the user, the interaction of that device is not supervised anymore, right? This is different to an e-gate. The electronic gates we have in at the airports today, right, there's typically a watch guard looking at you, whether you are presenting your own face or a fake face. Now, the second thing, that the device cannot be assumed to run in a trusted environment, right? So there might be some person overnight which tries to tamper with the device, right? In an e-gate scenario at the airport, that's different, right? This is somehow a protected area. No one can modify, manipulate the e-gates without being noticed. I can do with my smartphone whatever I want to do, and whenever the smartphone is on the table, right, or stolen, left somewhere, an attacker could do whatever the attacker wants to do. So the device needs to be more self-contained in terms of coming with its own protection measures. The third aspect is we have to use some kind of proven cryptography, right? Not the homegrown ones, not a cryptography which we just invent and which no one has looked at, no one has tried to attack. And it took the cryptography, let's say research, just 30 years time to find algorithms and understand how to design algorithms which are more secure and how to understand the security of that. So we want to use those existing algorithms rather than to introduce new ones. And of course, we want to use proven protection measures for implementing the authenticator, things which the industry already understands and which most smartphones already could support. And of course, we need robust user verification methods, which means that I can really trust, right, that the false accept rate is relatively low, that it's hard to run a presentation attack on that modality, right? It's not just holding up a printed face image, for example, or a tablet with a photo of a face, for example, to run a presentation attack. But let's look into the authenticator itself and how the authenticator could be attacked, right? So there is the authenticator, it's typically running in a multipurpose device, and now it depends a bit on how the authenticator is protected internally of how big the attack surface is in the end. So there could be malware running on that device, and the malware could just try to inject, let's say, false fingerprint, right? Or a false image, which is not the live recorded one, but some image I found on the internet, right? I could try to modify the internal reference database, right? The verification reference data. I could try to override the result of the comparison, right? If I say, okay, now there's a match or there isn't a match, right? This yes or no result, there could be just an override on that and say, yes, sure, it matched, even though it didn't. But so this biometric engine needs to be protected somehow, and this needs to be integrated with a crypto engine as well. So, and we want to distinguish between two different kinds of attacks. There are the physical attacks, where someone gets physically hold of my device and then now can run a lab attack, right? Take it in a lab, open the surface of the ICs, for example, attach a probe to understand what signals are there, to override signals in the chip level, right, on the hardware level. So this is a different kind of attack. And you could try to get into that. And people have learned to protect against, and we see secure elements being used for that. The second type of attack is a logical attack. And I would argue that these logical attacks in the world of the internet are much more dominant right now, right? There's a lot of malware out in the market, and people are installing malware on smartphones on one hand side and on their PC, even drive-by malware, right? I just open an image or I look a video, and at the time I process, or my computer processes that material, this might automatically install malware on my device, right? Which I don't know. Right, and we have seen such attacks like stage fright attacks on those mobile phones. So there's other attacks which do not require the attacker to get physically hold of the device. So this logical attacks. And so this is one categorization, right? It's either physical or logical attacks. And the second is, what could I do if I store cryptographic material on that device? The first thing is I could extract that material, right, getting the key out of that and then misuse that key even though I don't have access to the device anymore. And the second is I could misuse the key, right? Just misuse the key means it's still in the device, but since the device is connected 24/7, I will just misuse the key while the malware is running on that. And now let's look into the protection measures. The first thing is what I mentioned is a secure element. So we have learned to create some kind of vault around our private key material to make sure it cannot be extracted, right? It's in a very secured IC, right? And the IC is protected against opening the IC, so there's some gates on top of that, so it's very difficult to get the key material out there. So this prevents against physical attacks and malware from extracting the key material. But it does not prevent against the misuse of that key, and which is very important to understand. So even if in today's world where we have smart cards and use smart card login, people thought now it's very secure, we have the very, let's say, ICs which are common criteria, certified, right, EAL4+, very high certification level, so very well protected against physical attacks. But in real life, we found that people are inserting that smart card into their laptop, for example. They have malware on the laptop, and the malware would just ask the user for the PIN. And what would the user do, right? It cannot determine, right? It's not saying malware is asking you for the PIN, right? It just presents you the original or very originally looking PIN dialogue. So you would enter the PIN, sure, and now the malware can access your smart card, right? So it cannot extract the key material, but it can misuse the key material and log into all the different computers. So we had to learn that the user verification part of that must be part of that secure environment, if you will, right? And the secure element is not designed to do that. So we needed something else. And the something else was invented by the market is called restricted operating environment or secure operating environment, secure execution environment. Some people call it trusted execution environment. You see there's a lot of terminology around that, which typically means this is a new area. And there are some terms which are, let's say, tied to specific products. So trusted execution environment, TE, is typically tied to trust zone, a concept which is implemented on ARM CPUs, right? The CPUs we typically have in our mobile devices. It's a hardware supported by the CPU. It separates different processes or areas of processes which can run on that CPU. And you can run all this authenticator inside a trusted execution environment, which protects the trusted the authenticator from being tampered with by malware, right? It does not protect against the physical attacks, typically. In a lab, you could try to attack that thing, and you might succeed after a while, but it at least protects against these the malware-based attacks. Now, if you combine both things, right, the TEE and the secure element, you could argue now we can protect against both classes of attacks, right, the logical attacks and the physical attacks, which is the greatest security we can get over time. But it's very important to understand, without TEE, I cannot protect against misuse of the key, right? So TEE or some other user interface, right? It could be even a fingerprint sensor, which is directly hardwired to the secure element. But without that, we cannot protect against misusing key material. The third thing is very interesting to understand. This is presentation attacks, right? If I steal a device, what is a typical attack, right? We typically are focused still on the false accept rate and say, oh, it must be very secure and very low false accept rate, right? But what is the attack really? Would I bring 10,000 friends and try 10,000 friends and with one, right, it might succeed on a device? Unlikely scenario. The more likely scenario is, if it's a targeted attack, right, I might steal a device. I want to lift off the fingerprint from the touch display, right, because there is a fingerprint on that, and I might create a rubber finger with the right resistance and capacity and all these things, and then run that rubber finger and try to open that device, right, to run a presentation attack on that thing. So that's I think, a very important focus area for biometric research to understand how to make the user verification more robust against presentation attacks. So in the end, if we combine all that, you see, it's kind of complex already, right? It's not a lot of things we have introduced. It's just, let's say, the basic attacks we have seen and the countermeasures we needed for that, right? The cryptography for the attestation to understand what authenticator model we have. Then we have the different authentication keys for the different relying parties, the private keys to be stored there, the linkage to whatever modality user verification method we use. Right, the different implementation choices we might use, which are part of the attestation as well, so that the relying party will know what kind of authenticator, what security characteristics the authenticator has. And then, of course, use all the existing proven cryptographic methods on one hand side and biometric methods on the other hand side. And now looking to the, let's say, the threats and the classification of the threats, right? I already said there's the logical attacks and there's the physical attacks, and I said that logical attacks are, let's say, more dominant in the days of the internet. And now understanding why is that, is this the case, and what's the economics behind that? There's a class of attacks where the cost of the attack is primarily dominated by fixed cost, right? I have to buy a very, let's say, expensive exploit framework. Might cost $1 million, but if I can, let's say, crack out 100 million passwords from a server, it might justify my investment, right? But whether I take out 100 million or 50 million or 10 million, right, my cost would not change, right? It will be exactly the same cost. So I call this scalable attacks, right? This is where I do not have variable cost. I only have, mainly have fixed cost, right? Which is very good in the internet, right? If I'm a central attacker sitting somewhere in the world running an attack and attacking hundreds of millions of targets at the same time, right? I have the same cost. It's very good to calculate. It's very easy to scale in the internet. That's exactly why those attacks are so dominant. And then there's the threat number one in that, let's say, scalable attack class, which is essentially stealing the, let's say, the credentials from the server side, or phishing the credentials from the user, right? Everything you can do without attacking a specific authenticator. Right, this is class one. And now we have to understand what do we have to do in order to protect against this kind of a threat class or attack class here. The second thing is attackers would not stop attacking, right? Just because we have, let's say, now protection measures against number one, right? They would just focus on something else. And the something else might be trying to extract key material from my device, right? Creating new malware which runs on devices and would look for key material or passwords or things like that to extract it from the device, right? And if they can't do that, wouldn't succeed with that, they will refocus on number three, which might be misusing those kind of key material because the devices are online always, right? And even if that doesn't succeed, they might refocus on something else, which might be now you have authenticated, there's an authenticated session, and maybe I can hijack that session, right? And with that hijacked session, I can do something else. And even though this authentication is 100% secure, which it never is, but it's assuming if the authentication is secure, I could still hijack the session, which makes it so important to link the transaction, if this is a very sensitive transaction, to an authentication or authorization event. And right, so this is all the scalable attacks. This is something I can do remotely with primarily fixed cost, right? And after that, right, after we have protected against the scalable attacks, we have to look into the physical attacks, right? The things I can do after physically stealing a smartphone, for example, which is variable cost, right? I can do that for 100 phones potentially, but not for 100 millions of phones, right? Very hard to steal 100 million smartphones at the same time. But there are still 3% of stolen and lost devices per year, so there is still a significant number. So doing or looking into physical protection makes sense, right? It's just we have to do the first step first, which is protecting against the scalable attacks in the days of the internet. So very important to understand what we can do. And if you remember, all these, let's say, different, approaches for securing or for making authentication more secure, we understand that just by the way of introducing the challenge response cryptographic mechanism, the challenge response protocol, using asymmetric keys, right? And the key tied to some user verification and event, right, before I can use the key. Just by introducing that principle, we can already protect against number one. Right, there is no way for an attacker to steal key material from the server, which allows him to impersonate the user, right? It's because it's just public keys on the server. The second is I can't run a phishing attack, because even if it's a PIN-based authenticator, knowing the PIN without having access to the authenticator, right, without knowing the key material stored inside the authenticator, doesn't lead to a successful impersonation of that user, right? In that case, it doesn't help me as an attacker, right? I'm still not succeeding in impersonation. Third thing is I can do channel binding, which means I can bind the authentication event to the TLS channel to make sure that the server gets a client-side view of the TLS channel, and with that we can protect against the man-in-the-middle attacks. So just by using the principles I've outlined here, we can already protect against number one, regardless of the implementation choices. Now, we have a lot of implementation choices, and this will help us to protect against number 2, 3, and 4. Right? And essentially for 2, 3, 4, you see, there is no need for a secure element, really. But what we need is the TEE, right? The Trusted Execution Environment, or some restricted operating environment to make sure that malware cannot extract or misuse the key material, or that in order to protect against number 4, the user can see the real transaction and not the a fake transaction which can later be modified, right? So some trusted user interface which might be needed here. And if you have protected against that, we can then add all this physical attacks layer, right, the secure element capabilities to that thing in order to protect against the physical attacks, right? Great thing. So from there, it's interesting to understand what the consequences are, right? And one of the consequences is that we can break out the traditional trade-off scenario, right? Today, we have username password, and if you compare convenience versus security with username password, you'd see, okay, it's kind of, we have learned to deal with that, it's not really convenient because we have to remember so many different passwords, right? And we have to type the passwords on mobile phones, which is not good. But if we want to have more security, right, the convenience gets reduced. Right, then we have to add yet another thing, right? The OTP, we have to carry a smartphone or an OTP token, things like that. So we have either a secure or a convenient solution, right? Which is very typical pattern. So it's a curve like this, right? And By using this principle, which by the way FIDO is using, you can see that we get a right push in the convenience because the user verification is always the same, right? Does not depend on the relying party. And there's nothing wrong with that because the key material is different, right? I can still have my, using my same finger to, let's say, authenticate, to unlock the key, which is specific to the relying party, right? But it's the same finger. And using a finger is much more convenient than entering a password on a mobile phone. So we have a write push in general because it's the same modality for all the relying parties. And then we have scalability inside the authenticators depending on what kind of modality my specific authenticator implements. Right? Which just reflects that the convenience of authentication primarily depends on the modality we choose and not on the implementation choices or the protocol. And the second, the security now, right, we get a push upwards in the security because there are only public keys on the server, it's not phishable, we can protect against man-in-the-middle attacks, right? All these up-levels the security by default, and then we have a lot of scalability depending on the implementation choices of the authenticator itself, right? Whether it's using a TEE or a secure element, right, you get even more security in that. So we can break out of that scheme and we can have a more convenient and more secure authentication at the same time, which is kind of interesting scenario, right? We never thought that this would happen. So some interesting observations. So we have introduced that scheme a while ago and you might have seen that. Kid Hero buys $250 Pokemon swag with Sleeping Man's thumbprint. So yes, that's the question, what is user consent, right? Is putting a finger to a phone or a phone to a sleeping mama's finger, is that user consent or is that not user consent? So interesting area to think about that and to think about implications of the modalities, right? There is modality or there are modalities like speaker recognition where I have to speak up a phrase, right, which is more, let's say, implicating somehow the or implying user consent in this situation than just presenting a finger, right? There are other challenges with speaker recognition, by the way. Then the relevance of presentation attacks, there are some surveys indicating that this is really what we see, right? The more we use mobile biometrics, the more relevant presentation attacks or presentation attack protection gets. So this is something to think about in the biometric area. Another interesting aspect, and this is often forgotten, and this is biometric data is not secret, right? My fingerprint is on a lot of, right, is on this table, it's on that glass, right? It cannot be considered a secret. It's very similar to a social security number, right? I have to present that social security number in the US so many times that this cannot be considered a secret anymore. So we have to design our systems in a way that we do not rely on this data being secret. That we take into account this liveness check, right? It's only if it's live presented, the finger. That's the important factor, right? And then we have to make sure that this is not a presentation attack. Again, confirming that presentation attack is a very important thing, right? And especially this gets more easy over time as our camera resolutions increase over time, right? Just taking a photograph of me while standing here this way, right? You might be able to see my fingerprint, right? So minutia data and create a rubber finger on that. But there's nothing wrong with having a rubber finger as long as you don't have access to my authenticator, right? If you have access to my authenticator and you have the rubber finger, that's an issue and my authenticator does not, let's say, detect whether this is a rubber finger or not. So that's all the things together, right? And all the protection measures we have added here over time helps me to design system in the right way. Another aspect is attackers have already focused on devices, right? We have seen this focus on servers and the phishing attacks and man-in-the-middle attacks, but now we see a shift that attackers try to send out malware. And we see, different patterns in countries, one on laptops and smartphones because of the different, technical measures to install applications. And the second is in different regions of the world where app stores are dominant, right? And you can only install or typically install apps through the app store. In this case, malware is not that relevant because the app stores do a relatively good job to filter out the malware. On the other hand, in countries like China, where the app stores are, let's say, not really effectively used, as applications are sideloaded all the time, we have much more malware percentage in those countries. So it's much more difficult to make it secure. So, conclusion on that. So we have different authentication use cases. They lead to different requirements on authentication. Right, with this approach, which is also being used in FIDO, we separate the user verification from the authentication protocol, and hence can support all modalities, right, all user verification methods. We gain a lot of scalability. So we have scalable convenience and scalable security, and leveraging TE and secure elements is a plus, right? It's really helping to make authentication more secure. From a privacy perspective, we can limit the biometric data to stay inside the authenticator only, right? There's no need, at least for authentication purposes, to expose that data to the outside world. And of course, federation is a completely different level, right? As we have seen in the beginning, right? This is just complementary to that approach. I still have to authenticate to the IDP, to the identity provider. And this is where the first mile authentication comes into play. And with that, I want to conclude and thank you very much for your audience. Ah, okay.
Thank you for the talk. We also want some questions. Are there any?
Thank you for a very interesting presentation.
You're welcome.
There are several big players in this space. They seem to be dominating the fields of authentication. And they also have their own business. Now, in this setting, with a centralized service, the question is, will this be edible and acceptable to the big players? What is the incentive for Apple and Facebook to abandon their schemes and jump on this approach, which is somewhat similar but not identical to what they're offering and what is
Yes, very good question. So first remark on that, this is not a central scheme, right? This is a end-to-end authentication protocol running between some relying party, which might be a Facebook. And by the way, Facebook just announced they support FIDO, right? So they are on board with that thing. Very interesting. And you can authenticate. There is no third party in the middle of that scheme, right? Which is a good news. And this was, by the way, one of the requirements to make sure that we get acceptance from the big players, that we do not rely on yet another trusted third party, which is in the middle of the protocol and might be compromised for one or the other reason. Now, my second comment is on Apple. You might remember that there was a small biometrics company called, not that small, Authentic, which was acquired by Apple some time ago. And so in the early FIDO discussions, Authentic was part of that, so they were well aware of that thing. So they couldn't join FIDO because of the Apple acquisition being ongoing. But they understand the concept. And if you look at Apple Touch ID, they essentially implement the same concept without giving you necessarily access to all the components. But there are large players, for example, NTT Docomo, which have rolled out FIDO authentication on top of iOS devices. So this is one. The second part of that answer is now the FIDO Alliance has contributed a set of specifications to the World Wide Web Consortium, W3C, where we have created a web authentication working group. And this is to allow web browsers to support, to access the FIDO subsystem via a JavaScript interface. So that's essentially what we are doing there. Last week we published working draft number 4 on that thing. We want to get to a, let's say, a proposed recommendation on that and say, okay, this is the way. And we hope that all the major browser vendors, including Apple, will jump on that train and then support FIDO authentication in their web browsers. Yeah, so typically they do. They survive that. There's other market dynamics which come into play. This is who owns and who gates access to the secure element, right? So all our smartphones typically have a secure element, which is a SIM card. Right, it's a secure element, but it's not, let's say, really bound to that smart card. It's into that smartphone, and it's inserted there, and it stays there. But now we have added NFC chips, and typically with the NFC chip, there's another secure element, because the NFC communication, you need some kind of cryptography where you need the want to have the secure element. So large players like NXP, for example, they have integrated chips which contain NFC plus the secure element. Now, the next question is, could I use, and who could use that secure element? There's typically the device OEM, which wants to gate access to that, and there's the mobile network operator, which wants to gate access to the secure element. And so it needs to be figured out by the market still to what extent you can leverage the secure element. On the other hand, we have seen, let's say, the TEE, the Trust Execution Environment support, and that obviously a lot of those vendors are willing to put a FIDO authenticator in those devices and running and protecting that by the Trusted Execution Environment, which gives you, let's say, some hardware capabilities, right, because it's leveraging the CPU's hardware process separation capabilities. But yes, so that's what we can realistically do, and we hope that in the future storing key material in the secure element is also possible. SIM card or smart? Yeah. Hmm? Very good question. So I think there's, as always, it's market dynamics around that, right? So it's very interesting to see how the large players place their bets in that space, right? So for example, a mobile network operator has an interest to own the SIM card and to, let's say, have some kind of customer login, right? If you have an embedded secure element, the ESE, right, the embedded SIM card, it's much easier to switch from one provider to the other, right? Now I'm in Norway, I'm with a German telecommunication provider, right? I have to roam, right? If I could just press a button on an app and